Interview with Thomas Reisenberg, April 17th, 2008, in Washington, D.C., by Kenneth Durr.
We were just previously talking a little bit about background. And you said you started out with a history degree in undergrad.
I was a history major in college.
I'm sorry for interrupting. Okay. Tom, maybe you can guide me on what to do. These two people are on the phone, and they need to talk to you.
Really got started. All right. So you got a history degree. Were you pretty sure that you'd go into law at that point?
No, actually, I worked for 3 years. I worked for a public interest group, an environmental organization here in Washington. And then I actually worked as a newspaper reporter for a couple newspapers.
No kidding. So around here?
No, one was the kind of activist newspaper in eastern Kentucky called the Mountain Eagle.
Oh.
And then I worked for the Charleston Gazette in Charleston, West Virginia.
Wow.
A little different.
So, was it about newspaper reporting?
Well, I'd done some journalism in college and that kind of thing, and I enjoyed it. But I think I'd always sort of figured I'd probably go to law school at some point.
Okay.
And I just wasn't quite ready immediately.
Yeah, some people go to Europe and stuff like
right,
that. And
right.
You went to West Virginia.
I went to Eastern Kentucky.
All right.
Not quite like Paris.
So you went to NYU, is that right?
I did, yes.
Okay. Did you have a sense at any point along the way that you were going to get involved with securities law?
You know, not really. I didn't. And I really just sort of fell into it. I clerked for a federal judge. I actually spent a year at the Justice Department. And then I clerked for a federal judge. I didn't, not the regular order, because people usually clerk right out of law school, but I worked for a year, and then I clerked for Barrington Parker, who was a federal district court judge here in Washington.
Okay.
And then I went to Arnold and Porter for about 3 years. And when I was at Arnold and Porter, I worked on some securities cases, and I found them to be kind of interesting, and I enjoyed it. So,
What kind of securities cases?
There was a 10b-5 case involving Coca-Cola and its purchase of a company called Taylor Wine Company, which was an upstate New York wine company. And then there was another case down in Virginia that involved an acquisition of some kind, another securities case. Neither of them were any of the real famous cases, but they were interesting cases and had a lot of, I thought the law was interesting. It was developing in an interesting way. And then when I actually learned of a job at the SEC, and I was thinking of leaving A&P after about 3 years because I just decided I wasn't sure I wanted to be at a big firm for my career. A former Arnold Porter fellow named Eric Summergrad had gone over to the SEC, and he had mentioned that there was a job available doing appellate work. And I had actually done a lot of appellate work at the Justice Department and found it to be enjoyable, so I applied and got that job.
And that was in the general counsel's office?
Correct, yeah.
Okay. Who did you go to work for?
Well, Dan Gelzer was my boss.
Okay.
So
I just spoke with him the other day.
Okay, great.
What was it like working with Dan Gelzer?
Dan's a terrific fellow. I really enjoyed working with him. He's a very, very capable, smart guy, and just a really delightful guy to work with.
How do you run an office like that? I mean, you've got basically a stable of lawyers, and do you divide them up and send them out into special details? Are there specialties?
I think that's reorganized a bit since then, but they had it sort of organized into three areas. One was the group that mostly did appellate work, another group that did what they called counseling, which was to sort of review the activities of the other divisions and comment on them and work on legislation and that kind of thing.
Okay.
And then the third area was it's really sort of what a traditional general counsel ends up doing, the whole mixture of employment litigation, defense of litigation where the agency is sued. They also did FOIA litigation. It was like a whole grab bag of things, and that was sort of a third area that the group did.
So that's the nuts and bolts representing the commission.
And then the appellate group, represented the SEC in appellate litigation, either in courts of appeals or Occasionally, there's a there'd be a Supreme Court case, and the appellate group would work with the Solicitor General's office in drafting a brief.
So, what kind of cases did you come in?
Yeah, I had a real mixture of all sorts of things. Actually, among the very first things I started working on, it was an area that was really quite unusual, and it was some defense lawyers came up with a theory. In particular, it was a theory developed by a very prominent fellow, Art Matthews, who was a lawyer at Wilmer Cutler Pickering. And Art Matthews developed this theory that he invoked in several cases that the SEC couldn't bring enforcement cases against individuals because it was unconstitutional to do so. He relied on what was called the Take Care Clause of Article 2 of the Constitution, and it says that only the president or only the executive branch of government can take care that the laws be faithfully executed, and so he interpreted that as saying that only the president, only the executive branch of government, can actually go to court and litigate against people. The SEC can't do it on its own. And the SEC, of course, is an independent agency. And in fact, there's some law that talks about independent agencies as being more an arm of Congress than being an arm of the executive. So he brought this up as a defense in several cases. And I sort of got assigned the responsibility for arguing all of those cases. So, it was kind of interesting, and we won. We never lost. I think there was a Tenth Circuit case where it was raised, and there was a case in Florida where it was raised. The issue sort of got put to rest ultimately when there was a challenge to the independent counsel, the prosecutor, what they called the special prosecutor. Or the independent counsel, and a similar argument was made that the independent counsel could not bring cases against people because he or she was not part of the Justice Department. He or she had this sort of separate role, and the same argument on the Take Care Clause was made in those cases, and in the Supreme Court in the Morrison versus Olson case said that no, in fact, it is constitutional for the independent counsel to bring those cases. And there was enough similarity to that situation to our case of the SEC that people sort of stopped making this argument.
Did this Supreme Court case come pretty much when you're working on
it? It came in about probably about 1988 or so, I think. So
okay.
For the first two or three years, though, this issue actually came up several times. And until the Supreme Court case came down, it was still an open issue.
So you were on Art Matthews detail every time.
Right, pretty much. Yes, I argued against him, more than once.
So you would actually go into court.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
How about the SEC Solicitor's Office? Did you work with them?
Yeah. Well, over the course of time, I worked on a number of Supreme Court cases. There was an amicus brief we filed in a case called Pinter versus Dahl, which ended up being actually a very significant case for private litigation under Section 12 of the 33 Act. And we actually drafted a brief. I mean, I actually, and along with others at the SEC, drafted a brief that ended up really getting pretty much adopted by the Supreme Court in the positions we urged. So that was one case.
What was the issue there?
Yeah.
For the layman.
Sure. It involved the question of essentially who can sue under Section 12 of the 33 Act. And there had been some fairly expansive interpretations of Section 12. And somewhat surprisingly, Section 12 is a private right of action under the 33 Act. Somewhat surprisingly, the position the government took, that we actually took, was that some of the courts actually had gone too far in interpreting the law and interpreting who could sue, and we actually took the position that it has to be somebody essentially in privity with the seller. It can't be sort of third parties being able to sue. So it was a little bit surprising. Some people thought it was surprising because the SEC almost always, at least at that time, almost always took the position of the plaintiffs in litigation. And this was actually a case where we thought that the plaintiff's position simply wasn't consistent with the legislative history.
So you did an amicus for the defense?
Well, yeah, it ended up supporting the position of the defense, yes, okay. Correct.
And so that's before the Supreme Court. Is that something that Paul Gonson would have done then?
Gonson worked on almost all the cases that went before the Supreme Court. He didn't always argue them because the Solicitor General, at least in recent years, I think this is still the case. I've been gone for a while, of course, but they have not been letting the SEC argue the way they once did. At one time, say in the 70s, and even in the early 80s, they would let the SEC senior people like Paul argue cases. But there actually is one exception to that. Was another case I worked on was a Section 16 case, which involves the Section 16 of the 34 Act involves the ability of a it's what's called the short swing profits provision, which is that insiders can't trade in securities for a period of 6 months. Mm-hmm. They have to hold on to their stock. And it was actually a case that the Solicitor General let Jim Doty argue. So
he was general counsel.
He was the general counsel at that point. That was like in 1989 or 90, I guess.
Oh.
Must have been about 90, maybe. And so he actually got to argue a case, which was not very common. I think one reason was it wasn't a particularly monumental case.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I think they decided after they granted cert, I think everybody realized this case was not as big a deal as it might have been.
Why wouldn't the Supreme Court want the SEC to argue cases?
It's not the Supreme Court. It was the Solicitor General's Office at the Department of Justice.
Oh, so the Solicitor General's Office.
Right.
They
wanted to be able to argue the cases,
gotcha.
In part because the number of cases the Supreme Court has taken, you know, over the last 30 or 40 years has declined. So the number of cases per year where the Department of Justice files a brief has actually went down over the period of time, and they were finding that they weren't giving their solicitor, the assistant, the Solicitor Generals, enough cases to argue. They wanted to argue more cases, so that
okay.
They would be more reluctant to give out the cases to others.
Well, that gets to one of my other questions,
sure.
Which is how closely did you work with the Justice Department?
Well, I worked on a few cases, like, you know, those were the only real dealings I had with the Justice Department was on the Supreme Court cases that I can recall. I don't remember any other dealings. And so we had at least, there were at least two or three cases that we worked on, that worked on the Supreme Court. On that issue of constitutionality, by the way, we also dealt with, a similar argument was made against the Federal Trade Commission. And their ability to bring cases, mm-hmm. So we actually did some. We were coordinated our efforts with the FTC to some extent. As well.
So this was the big focus of your first few years.
First couple of years, I spent a fair amount of time on that. Yeah.
Okay. What were some other issues that
right.
emerged then?
Then I did a whole range of cases involving insider trading, broker dealer issues. Just standard kinds of 10b-5 fraud cases.
Insider trading was the point, one of the points at which it was, you know, fairly high profile.
Yeah. I actually ended up handling a few cases that were significant because they were among the first cases involving foreign individuals who were alleged to have engaged in insider trading. One of the first ones was a case called SEC versus Tome. It's actually spelled T-O-M-E, and it involved an individual who I believe he was an Italian who had engaged in some insider trading, and he couldn't be located. The SEC sometimes is able to seize people's money, right, but can't necessarily find the individual. And there's some questions as to service of process and jurisdiction over the individual or jurisdiction over the assets. And that came up in a couple of cases, or more than two. And one was that SEC versus Tome case.
Was that the first one?
That was the first one, I think. I believe that was the first one that went to the Court of Appeals.
Sometime around 88, 89?
Yeah, so 80, yeah, something like that.
Okay.
And there was another one called SEC versus Unifund, UNIFUND. And that was maybe a little bit later, but that was also a case involving a lot of jurisdictional issues. A lot of these cases involved personal jurisdiction issues and subject matter jurisdiction issues. Those are the sort of the two basic kinds of issues that come up when a court's trying to assert jurisdiction over somebody.
Can you define those a little bit?
Yeah, personal jurisdiction means is there enough personal involvement of the individual with the jurisdiction in which the case is being brought to enable the court to assert jurisdiction over that person.
Okay.
Subject matter jurisdiction is, even if you've got jurisdiction over the person, is there enough involving the U.S. and the interests of the United States to warrant having a court decide the issue? And we actually did a lot of work in that area in those days involving subject matter jurisdiction, because there's... you know, if you look at the securities laws just on their face, there are no defining jurisdictional elements. Either theoretically, it applies to everything that happens anywhere in the world.
Right.
Well, of course, a court is not going to say, well, we have jurisdiction over anything that happens anywhere in the world. So the courts came up over, it was actually Judge Friendly in the Second Circuit, came up with this approach to that issue. It's called the conduct and effects test, which is basically either have to have conduct in the United States that involves the securities transaction, or you have to have an effect on the securities markets in the U.S. And unless you have one of those two things, the court would say, well, it's too, the issue is too remote. You know, if you had a securities transaction, you know, that's in the United Kingdom, and all the people involved are UK individuals, you know, why would the U.S. court ever want to be involved? So
right,
courts would say you have to have either some U.S. people involved, U.S. people injured in some way, or else you have to have some significant element of the fraud take place in the U.S. In other words, it's planned here in the U.S. or something along those lines. And so we had several cases involving those kinds of issues.
Yeah, that's really good. That's the kind of thing I wanted to get at, which is the idea of when the SEC could move into foreign
right,
countries. How would Judge Friendly have done that? By taking a case, the SEC would bring a case where everybody was in the UK and all that, and say,
well,
this is going too far?
The first cases in this area actually, by Judge Friendly, were not SEC cases. They were private cases. There's one case called the Bersch case, B-E-R-S-C-H, was one of the leading cases. I can't remember one or two of the other ones. But so he looked at the issues in these cases, and he developed this test, and he was just one of the first people to sort of deal with the issue. He realized that there wasn't any case law that addressed the question, so he just developed what he thought was a sensible test. And that has been the established test ever since, with a lot of nuances to it, because, you know, how much conduct is required, what kind of effects are you talking about? I mean, there are all sorts of issues that have come up over the course of time as to how those particular tests are applied.
Mm-hmm.
And so there have been, you know, cases on that issue ever since in the last 30 years.
What was the SEC's position?
Right. The SEC is always, when I was there, took a very expansive view on the conduct and effects test. So it would always argue, you know, that the the conduct, it was always argue that, you know, that the test should be applied in an expansive fashion, essentially. So, to get jurisdiction in the U.S. over transactions. I mean, the theory has always been that, if you're defrauding one U.S. investor, even though, you know, maybe most of the investors are not in the U.S., but if there's an effect on a U.S. investor, then a court ought to have jurisdiction over the matter. And that's the way the SEC did approach these issues.
Was there ever any consideration that maybe that wasn't the best approach?
These things are always somewhat controversial. And I think over the course of time, there's been more case law in these areas, and courts have wrestled with the questions. And there have been a number of actually cases in recent years I've not been involved with personally, but there's been some Second Circuit case law and other cases where there is actually more concern, I think, about some of the more expansive readings of the law. And it's actually a fairly hot issue right now in the securities laws. When I came to Ernst & Young, I did some. We had one or two cases that I first involved here. Actually, involved one of the very first cases I worked on involved a case involving against the UK firm of Ernst & Young, and whether it could be sued in a securities fraud case in Montana. And so many of these exact same issues that I worked on when I was at the SEC were present in that case. And that case actually went to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. I argued in the Ninth Circuit for Ernst & Young.
And was the conduct and effects test still in
there? Absolutely. Yeah, that was the exact same analysis. Yeah. And we actually, when I was at Ernst & Young, we argued that there wasn't enough conduct, and we won on that issue.
So did the SEC ever succeed in pushing that back a little bit and making more space for Americans to prosecute people abroad?
Well, they haven't. I have not seen what their briefs have said in the last few years, but I think in general, there is a less aggressive approach to asserting jurisdiction. I think that has been reduced to some extent.
During those few years when you were involved, though, were things pretty much where Judge Friendly put them?
Yes.
There's an interesting case that came up, and it made headlines anyway, and things that make headlines come to my attention, which was involved the seizure of funds in a Hong Kong account.
Yeah.
89.
That was the Unifund case.
Okay. All right. And there was a lot of pushback in that, you know, the SEC's going too far in going abroad and removing this money from a bank.
Right. No, that, yeah, the, right. It was a controversial case because the way the SEC did it was we couldn't get. Let's see, how did this work? this is going back a little ways. We couldn't get. We didn't know who. Okay. It wasn't known at the time who the insider traders were, but we felt at the SEC that there was insider trading taking place in a trading account at a foreign bank, and so we basically we got a U.S. court that had jurisdiction over that bank because the bank had offices in the U.S. to order a freeze as to that bank account. And so that was, that actually was quite controversial, yes.
Did with the controversy, the terms of the controversy, other than the basic, you know, the SEC's overstepping itself.
Right.
What was the controversy?
I think that's basically what it was, that the SEC was overstepping itself. That essentially you have a bank that has no, that has done nothing wrong itself, is somehow, you know, brought in to the into the process, and the bank's issue was, and this is what you frequently deal with in these international cases, is that they have conflicting obligations. That they say, well, here we are pulled by the U.S. courts to, you know, essentially freeze the assets or do nothing, hold on to the money. But then, you know, on our local jurisdiction, we have contractual obligations or even legal obligations, you know, to respond to the interests or the needs of the customer. Mm-hmm. And so we're caught in, into two conflicting sets of laws. You know, this isn't fair. That's basically the issue.
Yeah.
And that's all that's that comes up, you know, in the international arena all the time, of course.
Is that something that the SEC would take into account?
Yeah, but you know, the SEC, particularly in those days, was very aggressive in saying, you know, if you in saying if you know if you have some involvement or some connection to the U.S. securities markets, we're going to assert our jurisdiction over it, and. You know, and generally, these intermediaries, banks, quite frankly, have been able to work things out. I mean, they've been able to deal with the local officials or local laws or whatever, and generally, the SEC has sort of gotten what it wants. You know, the classic area of bank secrecy laws with respect to Switzerland, which was dealt with in the early 80s.
Right.
I think you talked to Michael Mann at some point, and he was sort of.
He had a big role
in all that.
Did you turn to that as a model and say, this is what we did in Switzerland?
Yeah, I mean, there was a similar basis. I'm trying to remember now how the facts may have been somewhat different. But, I mean, it was a similar kind of situation.
Were there any memorandums of understanding involved?
I don't believe so. Yeah. Not at that time, no.
You talked about, at that time, the SEC was more aggressive in as you say, if there's an American investor involved, then we're going to get involved.
Right.
Is that, would you have rooted that in the staff's approach or in the commission's approach?
Well, I think the, you know, obviously anything that the staff does ultimately has to be approved by the commission. So I think it was both. I think the SEC was particularly in those days, was always very reluctant to sort of cede jurisdiction to foreign regulators, because the theory was always they don't do enough. They're not aggressive. They don't do much. And, you know, it's the SEC that has to be the enforcer of the laws. That was certainly a very strong view. Huh. That has been modified over, you know, in last few years there's been a, I mean, there's been some talk of how you defer more, and there's this thing, there's an article that was written by the current head of international affairs, this guy, Ethiopis Tafara, and he wrote an article recently about, you know, how you allow foreign regulation over broker-dealers. And, I mean, that's been sort of a big issue in recent years. It's always been an issue. It's been an issue for the last... I mean, since the securities markets became internationalized, I mean, in the early days of the SEC, there really wasn't much sort of internationalization of securities.
Right.
But starting in the 80s or so, it became much more internationalized, and a lot of U.S. people buying foreign stocks and foreign people buying U.S. stocks, and you know, so it got much more of an issue.
It was an issue when you came in then. The internet. I mean, that's a really expansive view of the SEC's, at the SEC's area, if you're saying we're going to protect people everywhere because the rest of the world isn't doing it right.
Well, they don't say we're going to protect the world, protect people everywhere. They say we're going to protect Americans, even though a lot of what might be taking place might be outside the U.S. We're going to be protecting people within the U.S.
One of the other arguments against this, I think, was that it would discourage foreigners from wanting to get involved in
right.
U.S. markets.
That's been the issue forever.
Was that considered at the time that you were working on these cases?
I think so, although... I think so, but the countervailing thought has always been foreigners like to come to the U.S. because, first of all, they feel they need to come to the U.S. because it's where all the action is in the securities world, particularly in those days. It's less so now. And secondly, that they like to come to the U.S. because it's considered to be a safe, well-regulated market where fraud is aggressively prosecuted. Mm. And so, they think... So the countervailing view is that foreigners feel comfortable in the U.S. when you have an aggressive SEC.
Okay.
So there's that element. I think that was always the prevailing view.
Okay. We've gotten into the international already, yeah. And that's great. In 87, while you would have been in the general counsel's office at that point, there was a study of international securities. It was pretty big, and all the divisions were involved in that. Was the general counsel's office involved?
Yeah, it was. I worked on it to some extent. The whole study was headed up by the general counsel's office, though.
Okay, all right. Well, tell me a little bit about the process. What drove that? Why did it come up, and how did you do it?
I can't remember if maybe Congress asked for it. Okay. I think that may have been what prompted.
I think that is the case.
And so, on studies like that, sort of broad, far-ranging studies that affect all of the divisions, the general counsel's office would usually do those.
Okay.
And actually, there's another fellow who was more or less in charge of it in the general counsel's office. I think it was Bob Mills, who's deceased. Mm. But I worked on portions of it, and lots of people throughout the commission worked on portions of it. It was certainly one of the most comprehensive analyses and surveys of international issues that existed. So I think it was certainly interesting and helpful at the time. It's long since outdated.
Things have changed. What was the part that you worked on?
I recall working on some of the jurisdictional issues and some of the litigation related issues. Jurisdictional questions over, the kinds of things we've been talking about.
Okay. So again, it's this. So you've given a lot of thought as to how far the SEC could go in other jurisdictions.
Yes.
Was the word extraterritoriality something that was used?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, people have often thought. I mean, to some extent, all of these cases involved some extraterritorial reach. I mean, there's the question just is sort of how far you want to go. I mean, and how much is required to be in the U.S. in order to justify the extraterritorial element of whatever the SEC might be doing.
So was the intent to get into the study what the SEC's view of this was at the time? Or definition?
I don't remember how much was discussed, but there was certainly some... There was certainly some discussion of it, but a lot of the study, as I recall, had issues relating to corporation finance, filing requirements, broker-dealer requirements, investment management, investment company requirements. That was a large portion of the study.
Right. Well, I assume this is how you got involved in the international legal team then.
Yeah, we actually then ended up at some point... Dan Gelzer actually thought we should, within the general counsel's office, have sort of more specializing, more of an emphasis on some of the international issues. So although I continued to do appellate work, and I also worked on legislative, I ended up having an unusual career because I ended up doing a lot of different things. But one of the things that I ended up working on was the internationalization area. And so... I guess since starting about 1990, we sort of had more emphasis on international matters within the general counsel's office. And that ended up actually being a little bit, being quite, being, this, being, a, being an emphasis to a fair extent on these on the emerging markets issues, and I got involved with that, which wasn't really where I'd been spending my time, but the I helped sort of coordinate a lot of the SEC's efforts with the developing markets in Eastern Europe and elsewhere. This was right at the time when Eastern Europe and Central Europe became, adopted free markets. Uh-huh. So Chairman Breeden was very, very interested in trying to have the SEC assist these foreign markets in developing their securities markets. And obviously, in order to have a any sort of securities market that people feel warrants their investments, you have to have some degree of regulation, or that's not going to work. So he organized, first of all, he organized sort of an advisory committee on called the Emerging Markets Advisory Committee.
Who would have been on that committee?
Well, it was a lot of very high-level people from Wall Street and others who came to Washington and met and talked about how the SEC might have an impact on helping these foreign economies develop their markets and develop some sort of regulatory regimes that would assist in developing the markets.
So this was a blue ribbon
thing. It was a pretty blue ribbon thing, yeah. So they had a couple of meetings, and I worked on that, and then Chairman Breeden also wanted to actually have people go overseas and work on spend some time overseas. So I went over a few times to Hungary and Czechoslovakia and talked to people, but I didn't spend in that context. I worked with the World Bank and the International Finance Corporation of the World Bank was sort of trying to help foreign governments develop some of their securities laws. Mm-hmm. And so we at the SEC helped them. We actually got some contractual arrangements with the IFC and with and then also I arranged to get essentially a contract with the Department of Commerce, which actually ended up sort of funding efforts by the SEC to assist in these foreign, actually it was with the AID, it wasn't the Department of Commerce, with AID to assist these foreign governments in developing their securities markets. And so we ended up, I arranged for this and got a guy who was working at the SEC, a guy named Bob Strahota, mm-hmm. To then go overseas and spend a year in Poland working on helping the Poles develop their regulatory regime. And he ended up then coming back after that and spent a career, rest of his career for the next 10 years or so, working on having these foreign markets, in giving advice to foreign markets. And he and others at the SEC started doing this all over the world. And so it wasn't just confined to Eastern Europe, but started doing it all over. Focus within the SEC for doing that came out of we decided at some point, I don't remember when, it was shifted from the General Counsel's office to the Office of International Affairs, which had been set up around that time. So they ended up, so Bob actually, when he came back from Poland, I think he went to work for the International Affairs, and so we just thought that was functionally probably a better place to do that kind of thing. It really wasn't the kind of traditional general counsel type thing that we're doing.
So when you were charged with getting involved in this stuff, mostly in Eastern Europe, I guess, at the beginning, there was no Office of International Affairs? Or
I don't think it had been formed yet, or maybe it had been, but it was really quite small.
Okay.
But ultimately, they sort of took over the task, I think probably around 1992 or so.
Okay, so I just want to dig a little sure. more into that, because this has got to be really valuable for the folks who are working on these angles. The Chairman Breeden wanted somebody from the SEC to go share expertise in
right.
Eastern Europe.
Well, he wanted the SEC institutionally to share expertise with Eastern Europe.
Okay.
And so in order to do that, obviously there needed to be some sort of lead within the SEC to sort of take responsibility for coordinating that and to try to make sure it's delivered appropriately.
Okay, so for and a so, time, that was you and
yeah,
the general
counsel. Yeah, I did that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a reference to an international legal team being created in a newspaper article. So
right.
Apparently you had a name for your organization.
Yeah, no, we had a group that sort of did a lot on the international area, yeah. I
mean, who were the people working with
you? There was a guy named Walter Starr. Walter actually now works for an investment fund that works on emerging markets. It's something called the Emerging Markets Corporation or something. It's comprised of former World Bank people. And so he stuck with it. And then Bob Strahota was the other one. Those were the two main guys.
Okay. And then you went to AID for funding.
Yeah, AID actually ended up giving some money to the SEC for us.
Why was that?
Well, just because the SEC didn't have a budget for sending people overseas.
Okay.
And the AID at that time actually got a fairly sizable budget to assist in free market development. And they actually provided funding to the Department of Commerce to develop a program, which I think is still quite active. And the SEC did it. They also, I think they gave money to some American Bar Association organization that got developed at the time. There was a lot of activity in those days, in the early 90s, in trying to, give advice, I mean, many people think maybe there was too much advice being given.
Yeah.
But presumably it had some positive impact. I certainly hope it did. These markets actually have done very well. Some of them, the Polish ones, have done extremely well.
Yeah, I mean, everybody recognizes there's this huge opportunity to do something.
To try to mold them. I mean, I think there are a couple things. One is to sort of help them get their markets together. And at the same time, having the SEC and the Americans, involved in that process is certainly helpful, to the U.S. markets and to the U.S. It develops ties between U.S. regulators and foreign regulators. Overall, I think it's a helpful kind of thing to be doing. In that regard, also, although I did not take the lead in it, but Chairman Breeden organized this Institute for Securities Markets, where people from regulators come from all over the world, and to have a 2-week program, and that's still very active. But that was another kind of thing that he ended up wanting to do. He was very, very interested in that kind of thing.
The international office ran that?
I think they ran it, yeah.
Did AID come to you, or did you go to AID?
I think we went to AID.
Okay. You knew they were doing all of this
stuff. Well, we've been talking to them about certain programs that they had going, and I think we'd worked with them a little bit on a couple of things, but the actual process of obtaining a grant, I think it was like a $2 or $3 million grant for a 2 or 3 year period.
Okay.
That was a new thing. That was our idea.
So when you went over there in the first few visits, was this just a matter of organizing conferences with people in Eastern Europe and talking generally about how we did it?
Yeah, there were a bunch of, there was a lot of different things. There were some programs and conferences. There were panels and speeches. There were sort of one-on-one meetings with people. There were drafting of securities laws and securities regulations where we helped them work on those. We worked quite a bit with there was a private lawyer named who was at a big Wall Street firm named Bill Williams. And he sort of developed a kind of a model securities law that we ended up, talking to people about. But I think with Bob's, the most significant, I think, was having somebody actually placed overseas for a year. Bob Strahota was there, every day essentially working alongside the regulators and trying to sort of work through problems with them and trying to, help them design inspection programs and help them design regulatory processes and help them on institutional and structural issues and we got the Jack Katz, who was the secretary of the commission and sort of knew probably better than anyone how the SEC is organized, how it's structured, who does what. And so when these foreign regulators were trying to come up with kind of institutional frameworks for their operations. Jack actually went overseas and met with people several times, and you know, so we organized that activity. At one point, there were some corporation finance issues on review of filings, and so I arranged to have a woman from our corporation finance division, Abby Arms, went over to Hungary for a week or two, a couple weeks, and sort of worked with them on some, you know, issues relating to that. So there were a bunch of different things. We had some people who worked on broker-dealer regulatory issues who would spend some time overseas, you know, talking to people about how things are done and going through regulatory issues. So.
It sounds like the Europeans were highly receptive to the
ECC. Yeah.
Was there ever anybody who said, well, you know, we want to do it this way. Thanks, but no thanks.
Well, I think there probably was. Yeah, I mean, I think from how I recall Bob Strahota's experience was probably mixed in some ways, because I think there were times when he felt frustrated they weren't really following his advice. You know, so I'm sure that happened.
Okay.
You know, happens a lot. You know.
Yeah. Well, you would think that there would be some sort of
right.
There would be turf wars or something.
Yeah, I think there is. Yeah,
okay. And then. We talked. You mentioned the SEC Institute, where people are, instead of going out, people are, I guess, coming.
I think they come in for 2 weeks in the spring.
Tell me a little bit about how that your involvement with that.
Well, I did work on it for the first few years. I don't think I sort of had the lead role, but I think it was really done by the Office of International Affairs. But I helped organize. I was on some of the programs in the first couple of years, talking about sort of legal issues relating to the SEC and its status within the U.S. government and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I believe I spoke about sort of administrative law issues, because that's an important area that, you know, foreign officials were interested in, and I think that, you know, that was an area that that was useful to them. But, you know, a lot of the nitty-gritty of those programs revolved around, you know, some of the other divisions played a very active role. We also, we would bring in, you know, a lot of prominent people to speak, and I did arrange for a lot of that. We had a lot of, you know, prominent regulators from other agencies, or, you know, people from some Wall Street firms, and New York Stock Exchange, you know, that kind of NASD, that kind of thing, would come and speak about different things.
What about IOSCO? Would you get other people internationally?
Well, to actually appear on the programs, I don't remember whether they would actually appear, but so it was. I mean,
these were more U.S.
Yeah, it was really sort of the U.S. people talking to all these foreign regulators, you know, and there would be huge groups of them. I mean, I remember the first year we were just astonished at the return we got of people who wanted to come, and they were from, you know, all over the world. Now, I think it's become much more institutionalized and routinized since then, but the first year or two, you know, we got essentially the top securities regulators, or, you know, like the head of the regulatory body in country, you know, 40 or 50 countries. It was really kind of amazing.
And so all this was fallout from the collapse of the wall and
yes,
things?
I think, to his credit, I think it was Chairman Breeden really was very interested in doing this.
Huh.
And he pushed for it, and he liked the idea. And he was very interested in international issues.
Well, you mentioned administrative law, and that was one of my questions, is, you know, it's easy to see how... You know, it's easy to see this in an American context because we've got a century or more of administrative law to build on. What happens when you get these countries that don't have that?
Right. Well, I guess that's a significant issue, and it's just, it's, you know, the point here, of course, is that, you know, what we have in the U.S. can't just be picked up and shipped overseas. I mean, it sort of reminds me of, you know, the very first time that some Russians came over to the U.S., and I remember reading about some Russian economic official went to look at Pentagon City Shopping Mall in Virginia. So, well, I'd just like to copy this entire mall and just plant it in Moscow because it's so perfect. And of course, you know, you can't really do that exactly. But I think the same thing is true for, you know, for the securities world. But, you know, you just try to explain how some things are done over the course of time. I mean, the thing that does make the U.S. kind of unique is the, and we talked about this, we always talked about this at these programs, is sort of the relationship between the private bar and the SEC. The, you know, that there is this role, this gatekeeper role that lawyers have, that others have, that, you know, you want to be able to you know, sort of have, the private companies want to act for the most part in ways that show their good faith and their interest in trying to do the right thing. And there are a lot of different players in that process. So it's not sort of like this, you know, just the SEC sort of sitting there and trying to hit people with a hammer all the time. Right. I mean, there is a sort of cooperative spirit to some extent between the private bar, many people who've worked at the SEC and want to make sure that things continue to be done in the best way possible. And, you know, those kinds of things don't develop overnight in foreign countries. There's no question about that.
Was this a surprise to some of the foreigners that's really how it works?
I don't know if it's a surprise. I guess it depends on how much background. We've got people in the early days who knew really nothing about the U.S. or how it's structured. So I'm sure to them, to the extent they really understood, part of the problem here is that there are a lot of conceptual things. I mean, one thing that I always was struck by is, I mean, you've got language problems in talking to people, and then you've got, these are sort of unusual concepts. It's not clear that you can even just sort of describe them and have it sort of sink in. I mean, if I were somebody coming in, you know, from some of these countries, I'm not sure I completely grasp it just because somebody's sitting on a panel explaining it to me.
Right.
You know?
Which I guess is the point, yeah.
Right.
Because even lots of people in the U.S. assume that the SEC just sits there and, you know, issues rules and everybody follows them, and that's how things get done. There's also administrative law, the idea that you can have this whole other legal system. So it would seem like those were some pretty big challenges.
I think they are very big challenges, and I can't say that I'm aware of how easily they've been adopted or utilized. I mean, there's been, you know, the U.S. in general, we have a lot of different programs in the last 18 or 20 years on foreign legal institutional development. You know, I mean, the American Bar Association started developing this program, where they send people overseas for about a year or so and help them work on legal issues. You know, there are all these different missions that go overseas. I mean, so there's a lot of that interplay. And I guess all you can sort of assume is that some of it rubs off. I mean, I don't think you can sort of expect, and I think this is one of the elements of all of this, is that, I mean, when you look at the cost that's, the amount of money the U.S. is spending, it's not very much money. I mean, in the grand scheme, the amount of time, it's really not in the grand scheme of thing all that much time. So if you're sort of feeling that you're not really sort of transforming these markets, I think you have to sort of realize, well, look, the only objective here really can be that some of it rubs off. That's, you know, maybe it's 5%, maybe it's 10%, maybe it's 15%, who knows? But some of it has some impact, some of it has some utility. And, you know, and more than that, there is the development of some ties and some friendships and some, you know, showing of goodwill. And so for all of those reasons, I think it's always been a useful thing to do, even though people could certainly say, well, you know, the foreign regulators aren't, you know, they're not like the SEC. They're not doing things the way, they don't have administrative law issues. I mean, I think that's too much to expect. I don't think anybody really, really realistically expect this. I think you have to sort of lower your expectations.
Yeah. Well, some concrete stuff. IOSCO, how much did you interface with them where you were?
You know, that was more international affairs. Did a lot of the work with IOSCO. I did spend time. I worked with our international affairs people quite a bit on different legal issues. But I can't say that I did an active thing with IOSCO. I mean, one thing that was quite significant in this area, though, that is probably worth talking about is that We felt that in part of the enforcement program, we, you know, the issue has always been getting foreign governments to assist the U.S. in getting documents or other information when there's, you know, when that information is located within that jurisdiction.
Right.
And we at the SEC, and this is actually more, I mean, this is Michael Mann's idea, but then I sort of carried through on it. We thought that the U.S. securities laws needed to be amended so that the U.S., the SEC, could essentially assist a foreign government in its enforcement of its laws, because if the SEC could do that, then you would assume that that foreign government would be willing to reciprocate. So, because and under the U.S. securities laws, up until we got the law changed, the SEC could only investigate violations of its laws. You couldn't investigate a violation. You couldn't subpoena documents from somebody unless there's a showing of a possible violation of a U.S. law, the securities laws. We actually got the Congress to change the law in, I guess it was 1989, which allowed the SEC to, we got an amendment to Section 21A of the Securities Act to allow the SEC to investigate a violation of a foreign law if the foreign government made the request to the SEC. And so that was actually, I think, a very crucial, I mean, people who have followed through on this in the later years, was a very significant development. And I, you know, I actually sort of drafted that provision, and we met with people on the Hill, and they all seemed to say fine. Huh. So we got that passed without, actually wasn't too hard.
Which is unusual, I guess.
It was called the International Securities Enforcement Cooperation Act of 1989, I believe.
So you had this vision for that act, that it would begin a process that would create more cooperation.
Right. The theory was that unless the SEC had the statutory ability to do these kinds of investigations when a foreign government asked for it, then unless that took place, you couldn't realistically ask the foreign government to do an investigation when the SEC asked for it. So we would say, well, we have the authority. You ought to have the same authority and provide for, you know, do the, if we're willing to do this for you, then you ought to do the same thing for us. And that had a very significant, allowed a lot more foreign investigations to take place in assistance of the SEC's efforts.
Hmm. Did it add greatly to the SEC's workload?
I don't think so. This doesn't come up all that often.
Yeah.
In fact, I really don't know how often it's been utilized. It has been utilized.
Okay. But as a matter of principle, it was pretty important.
I think that's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Something else that comes up in the area of foreign involvement was the jurisdictional MJDS with Canada, setting up
yes.
a multi-jurisdiction.
That was, I didn't have much to do with that. That was mostly corporation finance.
Right. So. Okay. So did you stay in this international legal group all the way through then?
I worked on that. I also ended up, that group filed some legal briefs on the jurisdictional issues I've described. But then I got sort of pulled in on a bunch of different things my last year or two that were actually a lot of fun on litigation reform, which is completely different.
Right.
But I ended up working on... I think it was because I worked on the Supreme Court case involving the statute of limitations, the Lampf case, and it was a very important case on the statute of limitations for Rule 10b-5, and because the Supreme Court agreed with let's see, how did it work again? ended up trying to remember what led to the interest in securities litigation reform. Was it the Lampf decision? Yeah, I'm drawing a blank. But there became interest in was the first time there was a Supreme Court case dealing with statute of limitations. And some private plaintiffs were concerned about a more limited statute of limitations than had existed previously. So there was actually some effort to extend the statute of limitations for private plaintiffs. Well, that gave rise to sort of a fair amount of talk generally about, well, if we're going to talk about sort of reform of private litigation, let's talk about it in a bigger picture. And there was a lot of talk at those that starting in the early 90s, actually originated within the accounting firms, but it spread to the high-tech sector and elsewhere about how everybody was getting killed by private litigation. And so the last year or so, this became a fairly hot issue at the SEC, and I did quite a lot of work on the position papers that Chairman Breeden took and that Jim Doty took and the position the SEC took on litigation reform, which ultimately led to it took a little while, but in 1995, Congress passed the Private Litigation Securities Reform Act, the PSLRA.
Right.
But the very early stages of that actually were starting in around 1992 at the SEC. And so I ended up spending quite a bit of time on that right then. So it was kind of a different thing. But
yeah, I recall something about somebody wanted it to be 5-year statute of limitations.
Right.
Some the court maybe set it at 2 or 1, and
yeah, well,
and it was a 2-tiered thing where
right.
you had the.
Well, you're very knowledgeable about this. There is 2-tier, but I'm actually trying to remember how Lamp came down. The SEC actually took an unusual position in the brief that ended up not getting adopted, which was there was a statute of limitations that was adopted for one of the insider trading laws, and we said, well, if Congress adopted that for that purpose, that should be the rule. Okay, I know what happened then. Okay, so this instead the Supreme Court, and that would have been, I think it was going to be a 2- and 4-year period or something along those lines.
Okay.
2 years from discovery. The general 2-tier thing is that for the shorter year is from the discovery, and the longer is from the actual event
right.
itself. So at some point there's finality. You can't just go on forever. But what they adopted in Lampf was 1 and 3,
okay.
which was the statute of limitations in the 33 Act. And they adopted that for Rule 10b-5 in the 34 Act because they said it was the closest analog, and that sort of showed Congress's intent to the greatest extent possible.
Okay.
Well, that was a very, very significant cutting back of the limitations period. Because up until then, this gets a little bit complicated, but up until then, courts had, for the most part, said, well, there is no limitations period under 10b-5, so we'll look to state law. And so they borrowed from
right.
state law, and state law generally was much longer. Like New York was as long as 6 years. So adopting this 1 and 3 period was a very significant. So as a result of that, there was all this furor, and there were bills introduced in Congress actually to sort of to lengthen it. And this, and the SEC did not want to start saying, well, we should lengthen it unless there was sort of a bigger assessment of private litigation. Generally, now this is actually an interesting thing because the SEC was, I think, probably for the first time, sort of wondering whether it's always in the best interest of everybody to have, essentially plaintiffs being able to have extensive rights. I mean, that there was some question as to the degree to which, the right that there needs to be some trade-off here, that there are some downsides to private litigation as well as upsides. And so, I mean, I think this was actually kind of a part of it was that, you know, there was more, there was a Republican president,
right.
And there was a Republican commission, and I think they felt that business was really getting sued more, perhaps more than it should be. So the very early discussions of litigation reform starting right after Lampf. Lampf was in 1991. So throughout 1992, there's a fair amount of discussion, and I spent a fair amount of time working on that. So.
Now, did the SEC get involved just because this is its area? I mean, were you doing amicus stuff? Or?
No, it was mainly the SEC was being asked. I mean, Congress, when there's bills and legislation involving securities laws, Congress wants the SEC's to be involved, and there were hearings, there was testimony.
Were you in some of those hearings?
I helped on the testimony. Yeah, I didn't actually testify, but I helped the people write the testimony.
Okay.
So Chairman Breeden did.
Where did the SEC come down on that?
Well, ultimately, I mean, this is now not until 1994 and 1995. At that time, there was a new chairman, Chairman Leavitt, and he was he had sort of more ambivalence about a lot of this stuff, and to some extent didn't want to take a real active role. It was my impression, although I wasn't part of it. I actually had the position here at Ernst & Young at that time, and I was sort of seeing it from a different vantage point. So.
Funny how that works.
Right, it was.
Well, how did you get in that position? When did you decide that you...
To work at Ernst & Young?
Yeah.
When I was starting around 1992, I just decided I wanted to go do something different. I think I'd spent enough time at the SEC, and actually somebody told me about the job, and I made some inquiries.
Okay.
So.
And you're working as deputy general counsel for an accounting firm.
Right.
What was your involvement with accounting before? I mean, was it?
I didn't have much.
Yeah. So was that a qualification for this job?
No, not really. I mean, one of the great things about this job, and it's really been a terrific place to work, is that it's. I learn new things every day, and I've learned some accounting over the years, taken an occasional course or program here and there. But we actually have a group of accountants in our general counsel's office who work with the lawyers on cases. So when I work on a case, I do a lot of litigation, but I also actually do a lot on public policy issues the same way I did at the SEC. But when we have litigation that I'm working on, we have an accountant who's assigned to the matter as well. And so he or she can explain stuff and make it more understandable. So they're invaluable, actually, to our to our functioning here.
I'm sure. How about your SEC experience? Is that invaluable?
Yes, absolutely. I'm sure everybody says I had great. Everybody says their SEC experience was a great time in their lives, and I learned a ton. I mean, one of the things that I must say is that working with the senior people in the general counsel's office. Paul Gonson and Jake Stillman, in particular, on brief writing and an oral argument, was an unsurpassed kind of experience, because they were just both such marvelous people to work with, and that kind of experience, I think, has carried me very well over the years. So.
Terrific. Well, you've carried me through an hour.
Okay, good.
And that's
is that all
where
you need?
We wanted to go.
All right.
Thanks very much.
So was that.